Economic Development and Housing Budget Division for Wednesday, March 10th will come to order. Senator Fredrickson. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman, thank you. Mr. Jeff Freeman from the Public Facility Authority to join expedite the explanation of the bill. Chairman, members, Senate File 2873 does several small changes, but significant changes to the Drinking Water Fund and State Revolving Water Fund. Plus, it makes some administrative changes in Section 1 of the bill, Section 16 of the bill. Just as kind of a reminder of what the Public Facilities Authority is, the Public Facility Authority is six commissioners, state commissioners, and they're chaired by the Department of Energy and Economic Development. And they make loans and grants from primarily three revolving funds, plus some other smaller loans and grants. Section 1 makes some administrative changes to the administrative structure of the PFA. Here, the bill makes some changes to the actual financial programs of PFA so that we can be sure we can utilize the federal funds that will be coming to the Clean Water Fund and also the Drinking Water Fund. But, Mr. Chairman, if it's agreeable with you, I'll ask Mr. Freeman to go through the financial changes in the bill.
Okay, a quorum is present. Go ahead, Mr. Freeman.
Okay, Mr. Chair, again for the record, members, my name is Jeff Freeman with the Public Facilities Authority. Program changes start on page 2 with section 2. And these are changes to the Clean Water Revolving Fund to comply with federal law. 2010 federal appropriation for the federal share of the Clean Water Revolving Fund monies contained a number of requirements that are very similar to the requirements that were part of the ERA stimulus funds last year. With respect to minimum or required levels of principal forgiveness and minimum required amounts that would be targeted to what EPA terms or has the phrase green infrastructure, water or energy efficiency improvements, or other environmentally innovative activities. That's EPA language that we just copied. It was also contained in the PFA's ERA bill last year. These changes that we're now making to the program statute itself, we expect this will be an ongoing thing in federal law. These changes follow the changes that were made with ERA as far as setting the criteria for the principal forgiveness and the green, if you will, the green infrastructure parts of the program. There have been some questions about the word green infrastructure is used a lot and often in different ways. In this particular case, the first requirement is these have to be clean water revolving fund eligible projects. So we're talking about wastewater, stormwater, other types of non-point source pollution projects. They've got to be a project that's focused on clean water. And then within that, there are various things that the federal law and EPA has developed guidance for. The green sheet that you have in front of you comes from the Pollution Control Agency. EPA is a document that's about 7 or 8 pages long describing green eligible projects. The PCA has boiled that down into kind of a nice back-to-back sheet that is provided on their website and provided to cities so they know what kinds of projects are eligible for those funds. Sections 3 through 6 of the bill amend the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program. This is the state supplemental assistance program for high-cost projects wastewater projects. The significant change, substantive change, is on Section 5, which is page 4. The change here is to change the funding criteria for WIF back to the way it was pre-2003, when WIF was provided as a grant based on median household income. In 2003, there was a change made to change WIF to be a deferred loan that was based on market value of the properties served. That since then, PCA has amended their rules for how projects are ranked. They've amended their rules for how projects are reviewed. And some of the issues, or many of the issues that were dealt with, led to that change regarding large lakeshore proposed lakeshore sanitary districts. Those issues have kind of gone away. So these changes would revert WIF back to the grant formula based on median household income, which really better targets this assistance at the truly difficult affordability problems. The cities that have difficult affordability problems with these projects, this approach would be target that better. It also fits well with EPA has now granted us the ability to do up to 30-year loans in certain cases for high-cost projects. So the grant combined with the 30-year loan is a better approach than the deferred loans that WIF previously was. Section 7 through 10 changed the small community wastewater treatment program. Starts on bottom of page 5. The changes here are a number of things. This is the program that is focused on very small communities, generally under 30 households, that have some wastewater problems, either straight pipes or raw sewage surfacing, very small lots, poor soils, small communities that have had problems for quite a while and rank high on the PCA's priority list. This program was designed to really deal with their unique kinds of needs for technical assistance and a program that can kind of deal with the with upgrading those failing septic systems to the soil-based treatment that generally should be a less costly way to go. The changes open up for the technical assistance grant portion. In addition to the U of M Extension Service being a service provider for technical assistance, it opens it up for some others as licensed SSTS businesses as well as other organizations. It better defines the kinds of work products that would come from that technical assistance grant. Changes in Section 9 would require a work plan and a schedule for the technical assistance grants. Everybody knows kind of what the plan is and can better hold these projects to a schedule. And then also Section 10 would provide the opportunity for some pre-construction design financing, since typically we don't make a construction award until the project has taken bids and is ready to go to construction. With these very small communities, they don't have the money to prepare the design documents and get to that point oftentimes, so this change will address that. Sections 11 and 12 deal with the drinking water revolving fund, and the same issue as with the clean water revolving fund. These changes are to comply with the federal law, which now requires the principal forgiveness and the certain amount of funds for, again, water efficiency and energy efficiency projects. So the changes, again, are very similar to what was in the PFA's ERA bill last year. This just continues those efforts and makes that a part of the program statute. Also, and continues a small portion of these funds to be used for very small non-community public water suppliers that are out of compliance with federal Safe Drinking Water Act. The one change that is different in the drinking water from the clean water approach, the trigger point for the principal forgiveness, we've reduced from 1.4% of median household income for wastewater. For the drinking water, this bill has it at 1.2%. The reason for that primarily is that the way the federal formulas work, the amount required for principal forgiveness, which is essentially a grant that's made as part of a funding package, a grant and loan funding package, the federal appropriation requires more money be put into these grants or principal forgiveness for drinking water than for clean water. Actually, about $6.8 million of the 2010 money has to go for principal forgiveness. In Minnesota, drinking water projects in general are generally less expensive than wastewater projects. Our concern is that if we kept the traditional 1.4% level, we wouldn't be able to fully use the federal funds, and we sure don't want to lose any of the federal dollars because we can't basically give it away. So we set the 1.2% level. That'll help, again, target the communities with projects that are still certainly high cost and give them some additional assistance. Just for your information, if you look at the average outstate median household income, 1.4% of median household income, the level for wastewater, is approximately $40 to $45 a month per household. So that's the point at which, above that level, the grant funds or the principal forgiveness would kick in. On the drinking water side, 1.2 is going to be a little bit lower than that. For a lot of communities, that's still a pretty expensive project. Larger cities generally pay significantly less than that, but it's the small communities that really don't have the economy of scale to spread the costs over a greater number of users that this is really meant for and will provide a significant help and benefit for them. Sections 13 through 15 is the credit enhancement program, starting on page 10. This is the program through which the state provides limited backing for city and county general obligation bonds that are issued for specific purposes. For counties, primarily law enforcement facilities and human service facilities. For cities, it's sewer, water, and storm water projects that would be too low on our priority list for us to be able to fund, or for some other reason the city wanted to issue its own bonds in the private market and finance the project that way. In this case, the state puts up a pledge that to the extent there's money in the general fund and a city or county cannot make its debt service payment, the state would step in, make that payment, and then get reimbursed from the city basically with interest through a tax levy or a state aid intercept. So that's the program as it exists right now. It had a $500 million limit to start with. We reached that limit last fall, and so we no longer are taking applications. It's been a popular program. There's quite a bit of savings that cities and counties, especially the lower rated smaller cities, can achieve without any actual outlay of cash by the state. We're requesting that limit be increased to $1 billion from the $500 million. And also, as part of this, we are proposing that the program be limited to only new projects and not refunding bonds, so that There's been, I think, about 20 to 30% of the program to date has been used for cities to refund prior debt, and that was allowed under the program. But with the increase now to $1 billion, it seems appropriate that the state would focus this on new projects where the state can get the benefit then of the jobs and the benefit of those new facilities rather than using it for refunding. That is the end of the programmatic changes, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to make a comment regarding the refunding. I know there are a couple of very small communities in my district, LaPorte is one of them, that have had really much, much higher sewer and water costs than they were anticipating because they were maybe given bad advice when they put their project together to begin with, and to the point that it's costing in a very depressed area where the average household income is much lower than the state average and even lower than the rural average, you know, spending over $100 per household to maintain those items. And maybe a little bit more indirectly, but that's important to jobs in that community too, because if they don't have a way to deal with refinancing or getting their debt load down, people are just going to leave town because they can't afford to pay for their utilities. So I'm just, I mean, I can understand there are two sides to this and see why you're trying to get new construction underway, but it's been that new construction restriction that's prevented them from getting help up to this point.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the issue that I just mentioned as far as excluding refunding would only apply to that credit enhancement program. But we are very familiar with the LaPorte situation. That was a project originally funded by USDA Rural Development. They use a criteria of 1.5% median household income before they start kicking in grants. But the bigger problem, as you know, with LaPorte is that the O&M costs were seriously underestimated, it looks like, when they went into that. And now the actual O&M costs are really killing them. And we, I'm not sure. I know we've talked with Rural Development, you know, that they are the primary, they are the funders for that one. We've talked with them about trying to look at some options if there's things that can be done to bring in some additional users into the system, which would be, I think, the ideal fix, or at least would provide a lot of help if they could have some additional users helping to pay for the system. We do have now something that we didn't have before, which is the ability to do 30-year loans, where before we were limited to 20-year. And so for that combined with principal forgiveness, I think we're going to be able to avoid future problems with those small communities in that way. Plus, I think we're all looking a lot closer at that O&M cost issue. I think LaPorte's deal with Rural Development, I think they're already at a 40-year loan on the debt side of that, so I'm not sure there's anything here that's going to directly help that, but we can work with Rural Development. We meet with them periodically. I know they were aware of LaPorte, and they had some ideas for some things they were going to look at. That's about a year ago, the last I recall, so I'm not sure where that's at.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's been a problem now for 4 or 5 years, and I know there's a lot of frustration at the local level, so anything you could do to try to brainstorm something to make it happen would be really appreciated.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Freeman, maybe you could update the committee on your bond sale schedule this year and what the effective interest rates might be.
We are preparing to sell bonds March 23rd, about $410 million altogether. A big chunk of that is refunding and then some new money bonds. Also looking at taking advantage of the federal Build America bond provisions for selling taxable bonds and getting a federal rebate on some of those, some portion of those bonds. I believe the ballpark on the overall true interest costs looking at about 3.25% right now.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Fredrickson, any final comments? Senator Cook?
No, I'm just going to remove the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to get in the way of that.
So we need to...
Experience. All right, Senator Cook, move Senate file 2873 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you very much. Very good explanation. Good bill.
Chairman and members, thank you very much.
Senator Cohen.
I moved too quickly.
Pretty good bonds.
So what was the name of the operation?
Senator Cohen, thank you for bringing forward this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 2931 is a fairly simple bill relative to the Minnesota Film and Television Board. And the delay has been, I had a question about the language I was trying to determine. Both Ms. Winters and Ms. Evans can offer testimony as to what is attempted with this bill. Basically, part of it is codification of what we did, I believe, in rider language, which needs to be placed in statute. And that's to allow for the 15% coverage where you have a smaller production. There's also provision that makes sure that you can go to up to 20% for productions outside the metropolitan area. So I'm not sure who'd like to start off in terms of offering testimony, but...
John, because he's going to talk about codification.
Right. Mr. Edmonds?
Mr. Edmonds?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is John Edmonds. I'm Director of Explorer Minnesota Tourism. As Senator Cohen had indicated, this is a relatively simple housekeeping bill, and maybe I can offer an explanation why we are recommending this to pass. The Film Jobs Production Program was funded in 2006 legislative session. At that time, the session-long language provided for reimbursement up to 15% of the film production costs. This language, however, was not included in the statute's MS-116U.26. In 2007, the Film and TV Board amended the statutory language to provide the ability to make reimbursements up to 20% of the film production costs for films that incur costs in excess of $5 million. And the intent was to have this option available in addition to the original language. Because the original reimbursement language was never in statute, having a portion of the language in statute causes us, Explore Minnesota Tourism, some difficulty when writing grant contracts citing the authorizing language. So very simply, we thought to address this problem, we'd like to have the original language that was included in session law added to the statute.
Ms. Winter.
Chair Thomasoni and members, I'm here to testify in support of an amendment that I have offered to this bill, which...
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
We have amendments.
At the outset, I probably should have moved adoption of the Delete Everything Amendment, which contains that language. I apologize.
Okay, we'll be handing out the Delete Everything Amendment. Senator Cohen will move the A1 amendment, put this in the shape that he would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion is adopted. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Ms. Winter.
My name is Lucinda Winter, Executive Director, Minnesota Film and Television. The amendment that has been proposed is a change to our statute, which would allow us to provide up to 20% reimbursement, not only for any production that shoots that expends $5 million or more, in excess of $5 million a year or a 12-month period, but also would include productions that shoot outside of the metropolitan area as defined here in Section 473. That's just a definition of the metro area. The reason I'm proposing this, and there is some documentation for this that was handed out to you. It says 2010 Outstate Minnesota Filming Cost Analysis. I asked a recent film that shopped New Ulm and Duluth, Iron Range, and the Twin Cities to provide me with an analysis of the costs that they would incur shooting in Greater Minnesota to get a contemporary handle on the costs. Because in the 4 years I've been doing this job, the problem I've always had trying to push production, encourage production into Greater Minnesota, where it does a lot of economic good, is that there are always additional costs when you travel your crew and your talent to Greater Minnesota because of hotels and gas and additional mileage charges, shipping charges, all those sorts of things. So based on that experience and with this example of the kinds of costs we're talking about at this budget level of a film, this many shoot days, which I just, it's a good snapshot, I am proposing that we amend our statute so that we can help defray some of the additional costs that are incurred and can try to, you know, encourage more production to shoot outside the metro area, because I do believe that the economic impact in some of our smaller communities is really, really beneficial. And this would not in any way change anything other than how we're spending any appropriation we may have. It's just apportioning it a bit differently.
Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee? Go ahead.
Chairman, if not, I was going to say that I'd move that Senate File 2931 be recommended pass and included in the chair's omnibus policy bill.
Okay. I've heard the motion. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Cohen, for
Chairman
bringing
members,
forward
thank
this.
You.
Thank you, members.
Nice bill. Appreciate that.
Thanks.
Senator Saxhawk.
So, there's somewhere in your area where they can stay for very much longer.
Wouldn't want to.
That's
Senator Saxhawk, Senate File 2712.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today, Senate File 2712, this bill will make modifications to all persons able to sell and install a used single-wide manufactured home. And with me today is Mark Bruner, Manufactured Housing Association, to give brief testimony, as well as Tom Joachim from the Department of Labor and Industry. He'll help answer any questions.
Let's go first.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and our association is the umbrella organization for modular manufactured housing in Minnesota. We represent, well, we have 8 plants in Minnesota that build manufactured modular homes. We represent sales centers, as well as the manufactured home communities or manufactured home parks. And this bill is a result of working with Senator Saxhawk, Senator Scogin, Representative Murdoch, and the Department of Labor and Industry really over the summer and up into the first of this year to address an issue related to reinstalling used manufactured homes that originally may have been required to have a frost-free foundation. Manufactured homes are built to the Federal Building Code, which is also a part of the Minnesota State Building Code. And the Federal Building Code most recently, but in the past, specific manufacturers would require that a home, when it's originally installed, be installed on a frost-free foundation. The Minnesota State Building Code has required since the 1970s, I believe, prior to there even being frost-free foundations for manufactured homes, that the manufactured home, whenever it's reinstalled, had to be reinstalled according to the manual that came with the home. The issue that the bill addresses is situations where you have a used manufactured home that may have a value of, say, $15,000, and the party wishing to sell the home has a willing buyer that needs to relocate the home. And yet, because of the 1970s provision that says that the home has to be reinstalled when it's relocated to the same standard that it was when it was new, means that $15,000 home will end up having to have, say, an $8,000 foundation system when it's relocated. The numbers don't work in those situations for the used home, so either the owner of the home is trying to sell it so perhaps they can upgrade to a larger home or perhaps go to a site-built home, and are faced with the dilemma of either having to, sell the home for $8,000 less, losing their equity so that the buyer can justify putting the home on the frost-free foundation where it's being relocated. And what the bill does is simply give the purchaser of the home an option or a choice. It doesn't require that you can't have the frost-free foundation. It simply says that in those cases, the purchaser, through a form that they acknowledge they're having the home reinstalled to and above the frost line foundation requirement, which is already in the state building code, and then would allow the homeowner to or the purchaser to have the home installed, and they don't end up with the substantial foundation system under the home, which is also an issue in terms of the home getting refinanced when it's a used home. Because in many cases, you'll have the home being put in a manufactured home park where it's leased land, and you have the concrete going into the manufactured home park when the homeowner doesn't own the land. So it really puts in place the option for a purchaser to have the home installed to and above the frost line requirement that's in the state building code. One of the issues that the department raised with us during the meetings over the summer would be that future buyers should be aware of the fact that if they're purchasing a manufactured home and say from the second buyer and the home isn't reinstalled on a frost-free foundation system, that they should be aware of that. And what the bill does is put in place a requirement that whenever there's a purchase agreement to sell a manufactured home that's installed above the frost line, that has to be indicated on the purchase agreement. And one of the ways the buyer as well as the seller will know that or be reminded is that the department already issues a seal for manufactured homes when they're new, when they're used and installed or reinstalled, so that the seal then that goes with the home will indicate, and these seals physically go on the home so a building official or property owner is aware of what they have, will indicate that it's in some way, whether by color or information, is an above the frost line installation. And so that's how we've accommodated that concern. Otherwise, I think it's pretty straightforward in terms of simply creating a choice or an option for purchasers.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we're going to hear this. I'm not sure, but I'm just wondering, what was the reason, the rationale for the law in the first place? I don't know enough about construction. I'm assuming that this is having a frost-free foundation makes it less likely that your pipes are going to freeze. I'm assuming, but maybe that's not correct. So I'm just wondering, what's the difference in the standards and what would we be changing in terms of the quality of the foundation?
Mr. Murner.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, well, what the change does, and I guess I didn't spell this out in my testimony, but this bill only allows a single-section manufactured home to be reinstalled on an above-the-frost-line foundation. In other words, if The importance of that is if it's a multi-section manufactured home where you bring two sections together on the lot, because you would have the potential for, you know, a little shifting or settling in a foundation, that we believe that those multi-section homes should continue to be installed or reinstalled on the frost-free foundation. With these are specifically single-section homes, and so the difference would be for the single section is that the foundation system wouldn't go below the frost line, or it wouldn't be a huge piece of concrete that would protect, you know, that would protect the home from all the effects necessarily of frost.
Okay, so Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
So I guess I'm thinking, so it's more a question of settling than it is a question of the insulation or the freezing or anything like that. And I guess that just brings me back to a house I owned one time where there was that kind of thing. It had been, one part of it was on a slab and one part of it was on a foundation, and the whole thing kind of shifted. So doesn't that make it likely? I mean, I understand the cost. Mm-hmm. Part of it that you're talking about, and you want these to have some value, so I understand that, but it also seems like the trade-off then is that they're going to be perhaps more susceptible to the kinds of damage that might happen from shifting over time with the freezing and thawing, and I don't know, is that a concern? Or
one of the things that the bill does is put in the notice to the purchaser, if this is their choice to do this, that it recommends that they have the home checked in the spring for any releveling needs in case there is any shifting, so that you could have that taken care of. So, you know, in the event that were to happen, that they would be able to address it before it got too serious over a number of years.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Wakeham, you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Mr. Bruner discussed the seal, and Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Did we try to eliminate that job today, or that one of them?
From 30,000 feet. Mr. Bruner addressed the issue of the seal, and I just want to confirm, because I think that's one of the reasons why it's here before this committee. We currently have a fee for the installation or reinstallation of these homes, whether they're single wides or double wides. All this will be is for us to develop a different colored seal so that it's recognizable that this home has signed a consent form. The installer, whoever installs a home, and when the purchaser signs this consent form, is required to send a copy of that consent form into us so we can recognize that. We track all of the installations in Minnesota, so if there is an issue that comes up, we'll know right away if there was a above-ground foundation system versus the frost-free foundation system. And yeah, will there are some cases where the homes be moving? Yes. But a lot of homes are installed on good soil conditions where they don't move. This does give the homeowner the acknowledgement that if you sign this consent form, you may have to re-level your home once in a while if something happens, you get a bad frost problem. But once a home is set on ground conditions, they don't move a whole lot. So I don't think this will be a problem, but this is something that as from our department, wanted to look at addressing with Senator Saxog and the others what is affordable housing and how can we continue to keep these houses available to the public.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog.
And just after both these people spoke, I think the last word is, in a lot of ways, this is an affordable housing type bill, because many of these are entry-level living, especially in our area, Senator Olson, where you know, it's possible for people to get into housing, and if they have to spend this type of money on their foundation, it just isn't going to work.
And it seems to me, if I simplify this bill, we want everybody to understand what's going on.
Exactly.
When there's a sale of one of these homes, right?
Mr. Chair, that was the intent of the consent form. I think we've even changed the color of the consent form to make sure it's very noticeable that the selling or the sale or the closing of the home, and that the owner's recognize this when they purchase the home.
And will it be the, I suppose, the seller or the realtor are the ones who are responsible for informing the buyer of what they're signing? Is that how that works?
Yes. Chair, yes.
Okay. All right. Senator Olson.
Well, and Senator, Mr. Chair, I really have mixed feelings about this, I have to say. I mean, we all come from a similar area, and we know what the issues are in terms of housing. And I can certainly see Senator Saxhog's point about wanting, you know, to try to – some housing is better than no housing. But I'm also concerned that people get into a situation where, you know, if someone's trying to sell them a house, and we have a lot of those situations, a lot of places where that's – those are the only houses people can afford to buy that still, even though it's a small amount of money, it's kind of the only investment they have, and it's already an investment that's going to depreciate a lot differently than a house is. And so we want to try to make sure that at least we can maintain that investment as much as possible. So I guess I just have to say I don't know what the right thing is to do. I guess I sort of feel neutral about it because I can see both sides of the issue, and some housing is definitely better than none, but I don't think this is a preferable way to go from the sounds of it, unless you're really clear about your soil, and you know maybe there are some situations where settling is less of a concern.
And I think, if I understood the explanation, that this will happen very, very infrequently, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, Mr. Bruner?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I mean, manufactured homes, once they're installed or located somewhere, don't typically move, at least not, you know, not very often. They're not, you know, what they were maybe 30 years ago, old mobile homes. You know, so, you know, no, this isn't something that happens a lot, if you will.
Thank
you.
Okay.
So, any other comments or questions? Senator Saxhog.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Senate File 2712 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Economic Development Budget Bill.
Okay. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you,
all
Mr. Chair,
very
members.
Much. Cap, we got another meeting scheduled or no?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do have a meeting for Monday where we'll hear more omnibus bills.
Okay.
Potential.
Meeting adjourned.